Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 16th, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside this afternoon is Bradley Hansen, Lutheran Spirituality, Strengths and Weaknesses of Lutheran Spirituality, number 99-9. Let's listen in.
And this is the last of it in a series on Lutheran spirituality. First of all, I got to put in a plug here at the bookstore, because they've got a couple of my books, and you can't maybe read this. The blue doesn't show up very well, I guess. But I have the book Teach Us to Pray, and also An Introduction to Christian Theology, which is a readable introduction to contemporary Christian theology. And I think they have, at least this last evening, they had one copy of each of them still there. So in case you're interested, why? Done my little pitch there for the workshop. Today's topic, this is the ninth in this series, the ninth and the last, and the subject of it is taking stock. And this is these presentations are based on a book that I've just completed. It will be coming out in January, supposedly. That's the schedule anyway, on Lutheran spirituality. And this is a session in which we're kind of looking back and making assessments of strengths and weaknesses of Lutheran spirituality. Maybe just to recap quickly, what I did is to identify seven elements which I think together are characteristic of Lutheran spirituality. A number of them are shared by other traditions, but I think the combination of the seven together is distinctive of Lutheran spirituality. By the way, I understand spirituality as a faith plus a path. In other words, that it is a faith that has a certain perspective on life and the world, but it's not just a set of ideas, it is something that's lived, it's a conviction. So there's a faith there, but that faith also is nurtured by and expressed in various practices. And that's what I mean by a path, where there is those elements which express and nurture that faith. In any case, these are some characteristics here that seems to me that the Lutheran spirituality has a darker interpretation of the human condition than much that happens in our culture, certainly, and that it's even a darker interpretation than is common in many other Christian traditions. That we would say such a thing as that we are that it is God and God alone who sets us free from our persistent and deep problem of sin. That there are other Christian traditions that say that, but they're a minority, I think. This second one here is really what's meant by justification by grace, but it's a matter of what is an experience, and it's a certain kind of relationship that is meant there. It's not just a set of ideas, it's not just a doctrine, but it's a certain relationship. And I think that relationship is characterized as trust in God's merciful grace. And we'll come back to that a little later. Ours is a tradition, a Lutheran tradition, in which the primary emphasis is upon how do we meet God, how does God encounter us. The primary emphasis falls on words, the word of God coming to us through words. So scripture and proclamation, whether that's preaching or whether it's one-to-one kind of testimony that happens between people or within the family. And also, of course, music is a powerful source of that, the expression of the word that feeds us. And so ours is a tradition that has been the primary means of grace. All you have to do is compare us with, say, a Roman Catholic tradition, which is primarily sacramental, and you can see that right away. The emphasis given to sacrament in the Roman Catholic tradition is, and the lesser emphasis given to, say, the sermon, for example. But in the Lutheran tradition, there is a stronger emphasis on, there's a considerable emphasis upon God meeting us also through physical symbols, and the central physical symbols there are baptism and the Lord's Supper. And so that, in that respect, we are distinguished from most other Protestant traditions, really, in this regard. So, for instance, here, if you look at a kind of framework of major Protestant traditions, those Protestant bodies that are up at that end of things, sacraments and physical symbols generally are less prominent than they are in the Lutheran tradition. I think Lutherans and Anglicans or Episcopalians are very much kind of middle ground bodies in that regard. That sacraments are quite important, but probably word is more important. Okay?
They're also the liturgical churches, and those other ones probably aren't.
And that's another feature, of course, that where we, the Anglican and Lutherans, in their worship practices, have used kind of the Western Rite liturgy as at least as a major part of their tradition, sure. And that shows our kinship, our closer kinship to the Roman Catholic tradition in another way as well, sure. Then I think in this and the Lutheran tradition also that there is, it is a tradition that emphasizes, it is a communal spirituality. There's a lot of spirituality today, which is sort of the Lone Ranger sort of stuff, individuals kind of putting together their own packages. I think Lutheran spirituality, with most other Christian spiritualities, I think is a communal spirituality, whether it's the importance of belonging to a community of faith is held up. But the emphasis here in the understanding of church is as the church is a community of believers rather than having a certain kind of governmental structure to it as being essential to it. And that would distinguish Lutherans, say, from, on the one hand, the Anglicans, and on the other hand, the Roman Catholics, I think, and also from the Orthodox in that respect. In all those traditions, a certain kind of governmental structure is understood as being essential to the fullness of the church. In the Lutheran tradition also, there is, you have a profound loyalty, I think, to core church traditions, and yet kind of freedom to incorporate or use or not use other church traditions. And then finally, a kind of two-kingdom, what's often called a two-kingdom kind of ethic. Those are the things that we've talked about earlier. And today, then, what I want to do is to step back and take a look at the Lutheran tradition and try to identify some, well, start out with some weaknesses. And I'll have a kind of short list, only three. You know, I'm sure you could add more. But some shortcomings. It has been patriarchal. It has been very slanted towards men. My golly, you can read most of the histories you can read about the Lutheran tradition. Women are almost invisible in those histories. One of the people we have in the village right now, Deanne Lagerquist, has been one of the people that's done a fair bit to try to kind of compensate in that regard, that she's done some research on the contributions of Lutheran women. But on the whole, it has been a patriarchal tradition. And now, of course, about two-thirds of American Lutherans are in churches that where women are now able to serve as ordained ministers, but about one-third, roughly, are in churches where that's not the case. But even just that alone does not solve everything, as you probably are aware, because it's also a matter of language and practice. So it isn't enough just to have a woman fulfilling the classical kind of hierarchical role. So there's a lot to be done yet, I think. there's been some progress made here, but there's a lot yet to be done. Now, this is a problem that's not peculiar to Lutherans. I mean, you could say this, I think, virtually every Christian denomination. So it isn't peculiar to Lutherans. The next two are more, maybe not peculiar to Lutherans, but certainly they wouldn't apply to all other Christian denominations. That is that Lutheranism is heavily Eurocentric. There are about 61 million Lutherans in the world. So, I mean, that sounds like a sizable number, but it's sort of dwarfed when you compare it, say, with roughly a billion Roman Catholics. But we're, you know, Lutheran Church is considerably larger than a number of other Protestant churches. However, of these 61 million, 61% of them are in Europe. Another 14% in North America, U.S., Canada. Now that makes a total of 75%. And you know, while there are some non-Northern European Lutherans in both of these categories, in Europe and in the United States, particularly, I think, most of them, it's very heavily Northern European. So at least you could say we're probably approaching about 75% European. Then when you add on to that the fact that of the other 25% that are in the third world, there's not an insignificant number of those, for instance, in Brazil and in Australia, that are really European immigrants. So there's a very high percentage of Lutherans that are Northern European. Now, that's beginning to change, but that's been our heritage. And it's particularly troublesome when you think of the fact that of the 61% in Europe, a lot of them are simply nominal members of the church. Well, I mean, that'd be true, of course, of all church statistics, but there's probably an unusually high percentage of them of European Lutherans that are nominal members of the church. And actually, now that they've changed the tax laws, the church tax laws in several countries in Europe, there's going to be more people bailing out Lutheran churches there. So those churches have been declining in their numbers. Where the growth has been happening has been in third world countries. Okay, but that's a small group, right? So. It's a question then of whether Lutherans are able to kind of break out of their ethnic enclave, you might say. Are they able to reach out and embrace other cultures? Now, when you add to that another shortcoming, that Lutherans have been uneven. That's probably a soft way to say this. I mean, a kind of gentle way to say this. They've been uneven in their evangelism. That Lutherans, and part of this is simply because of heritage. When you think that, you see, so many Lutherans have this European background where they came from a state church setup, where they were the church. The church, the Lutheran church, you know, was the church in Sweden, in Norway, Denmark. Okay? And in Germany was a different situation where you had so many different little principalities in Germany for so long. But in any case, you had that kind of state church mentality where you didn't have to go out there and kind of win new people, you see, is over against someone like the churches that have been, that had to deal with the frontier in this country. The Baptists, for example. Those were the folks that were out there having the revivals, reaching the unchurched, you see, and there's that strong dynamism to reach out to the unchurched. Lutherans have had some, they've had some movements in that direction, particularly in its own pietistic elements. And so they're like, say, in the latter part of the 17th century and into the 18th century, at the formation of many mission societies in Lutheranism, both kind of home mission and also foreign mission. But there are some questions, you see, that are going on here, particularly when you consider our cultural context. Now, for some of you, this is review again, but I've talked about the fact that we live in a time in which there's greater pluralism, greater religious pluralism. So people are bumping up against lots of different folks of different beliefs. There is greater individual autonomy or choice. People feel like they have lots and lots of choices religiously. And then there is more elective ties to religious institutions. Okay? Now, this is a time then in which you can't just rely upon people who had a Lutheran background that they're going to remain Lutheran. And so you've got to be out there reaching out to people. But ours is a heritage, and the Lutheran heritage, that has not been strong in that. It's not been our long suit. Although there have been, again, Lutheranism is a family of spirituality, so there have been kind of evangelical, charismatic elements within that that have, for whom that has been a very important factor for them. And so, but it's, that's not been the predominant kind of thrust of the Lutheran tradition. So I think there are those shortcomings there. Maybe I'll just pause there and see if you have any comments or questions about this so far before I go on and identify some strengths. But maybe we can talk a little bit about what any of these shortcomings or weaknesses. Or if there's others that you want to bring forward.
There's something about the patriarchal, though, in our congregation, the women are doing just as much as the men. I guess I got two comments. One Presbyterian friend of mine once said that he was very sorry to see women get on the governing board, not because they didn't do a good job, but now they were doing all the work, and the men said, well, they're doing it, so we don't have to, and say, no, they don't show up on Sunday and go play golf.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said it was really a detriment to the church. But one thing I have observed in our congregation, though others may not be the same, is that the families where the fathers participate, the children are active, even as they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
The families where the mothers are the ones who are participating, the fathers are almost not seen. Rarely do we see the children after they come, they're confirmed.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Has there been any study to that, obviously your experience? Do you know whether it's broader than?
I don't know if it's broader than our congregation or not, but that's something that we've observed. The numbers, I'm not the one who came up with that.
Yeah,
that's
interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an interesting. It would be the sort of thing you'd think it would be easy to research,
right.
Actually. Yeah. Any other thoughts, observations, questions?
I guess I'd be curious to know or understand, you know, from the pastors that, you know, come from this patriarchal,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of a history or culture within our current church. There is generational change that occurs over time, and so that you have, you know, a period now of our most senior pastors who are in the church and bishops and are the leadership of the church, you know, at large, if you will, as well as a senior pastor often in a congregation that is kind of ushering out an era. But I've also had discussions with pastors that are, you know, like a 10 or 15 year younger graduating class, I guess, if you will, that had a whole different focus put on much of how they were coming out and what they were going to be doing in their ministries, and a lot of the liberalism and so on and so forth that came up through the 60s and 70s. That was also introduced into that education. I mean, you look at some of the colleges and stuff as they kind of shifted that as well.
Sure.
And like in our congregation, we've been there for about 10 years, and we've always had a senior pastor who's been a man, an assistant pastor or associate pastor who's been a woman. And I was, as you were talking about this, I was thinking, I wonder, you know, statistically or what the numbers were on all different congregations in the U.S., how many places it were that that model was reversed, where you had a senior pastor was a woman, and the associate pastor was a man, or you know, just some of those kinds of things. And so how as we move forward, what are the things that are being promoted and taught relative to these types of issues as we move forward in today's seminary that are not going to be really hitting the congregations as they go through their retirement call process and everything of that ministry leadership over the next 15 or 20 years?
Well, sure. I think that, for example, the now, for instance, in Lutheran seminaries, there would be more attention given to feminist literature than there would have been, say, 15 years ago. There would also be, on the whole, on average, I would think, more women faculty. However, my impression is that still it is preponderantly male faculties. Now, that's not in and of itself the decisive factor. Because you can have for example, a man who thinks in ways and acts and behaves in ways that are very agreeable to a feminist understanding of how organizations and groups ought to work. On the other hand, you can have a woman who operates. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, I don't think, changed anything, you see. I think she operated pretty much as a man. But I think it's going to take time. And it's already the case. I mean, it's interesting you're talking about senior pastor and associate pastor. My understanding is, and in talking and reading some about this, is that a number of women, where it's been difficult for them, it hasn't maybe been always so difficult for them to get the first call, although I was talking to someone within the last 2 weeks, I can't remember who it was, who she waited 6 years. After she had been finished seminary, she waited 6 years for her first call. Now, this was back in the 80s, but I think it's often that second or third call where it has been more difficult. And in the situation of a woman being the kind of a senior pastor of a large church, I think that is quite infrequent, Jeff, my impression.
In Presbyterian seminaries, it's sort of coming from the bottom up. The students that are coming in are predominantly women. And so at some point in time, that balance will begin shifting because those women are going to be graduating seeking calls.
Sure.
Was that 7 year wait the first her first call or
that was her first call, yes.
As head of staff?
Yes, I think so. I mean I don't know all the circumstances. I mean there may have been other things involved there that say she may have been limited as to location. Mm-hmm. You see, I don't know. I didn't inquire into all that. And whether or not she would have taken both kind of the pastoral role, or was she willing to be an associate or assistant, that I don't know either. I didn't inquire into all the details, but I thought it was striking, and she was, she was very aware that was something that she, and that she felt deeply about, that she had to wait that long in order to get a call, that the church wasn't ready to receive her yet. So I think there's been progress made, but I think there's more yet to be made. And you're right, I think that the numbers of women going to seminaries has increased in Lutheran circles as well. My understanding is that in Lutheran circles that there was quite a high attrition rate among some of the older women now that had gone through seminary. See, they started ordaining women in 1970, and some of those people that went through in the first 10 years, let's say, that there was a high attrition rate, that in the sense that they may have finished seminary, they may have gotten out first call, but maybe the difficulties that they encountered were such that a good number of them dropped out of the ordained ministry. Now, I think that's gotten better, but it is not a piece of cake yet, I don't think. So it's still something I think that the Lutheran churches are wrestling with.
Right.
Yes?
I think, too, though, when you're talking about senior pastors and associate pastors, right there, you still have the patriarchal system built in. You still have somebody
sure.
with power and
exactly.
somebody working under them. So right away,
sure.
that's a system within the congregation
yeah.
that probably needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
And I think, when you think of it in terms of the timelines, that we tend to want things to happen a lot faster than they do. Maybe one of the good things or one of the advantages is in transition, even if this is the way that it has worked out, that just getting women from seminary into pulpits and into those leadership roles in ministry, maybe this is that next step that will happen because of the way we are. And then as we move forward, and like I say, this generation of our senior leadership, and then she starts to retire and exit and all that, that we're poised for that next step.
Yeah,
it can happen.
Yeah, I think it'll happen gradually, but it isn't just going to happen automatically.
Because, it's not only the dynamic in the mix of pastors that are out there, it's also the dynamic of the congregations
mm-hmm.
as well.
Oh, you bet. Very much so.
Your comment that it took this only, 6 or 7 years or something, and don't know the case, so I'm not going to comment. I know that when we were interviewing 15 years ago for pastor, I was on the call committee, and we had one woman apply, and it happened to my wife, and I took her out to dinner, and we both shook our heads and said, uh-uh. Now, my wife was very much in favor of women and this kind of stuff, but we said she just plain flat out would not fit with this congregation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that kind of thing you have to look at. We were looking strictly at the individual.
Sure. No, you have to.
That's you label those shortcomings, you can point to all kinds of examples of women bishops in the church.
Well, not all kinds of examples, but
well,
a few.
Point to those kinds of examples. But you call them shortcomings, but I suppose most Lutherans as a whole wouldn't call it a shortcoming.
The shortcoming of that it's patriarchal?
Yeah, that's not a problem.
Yes.
I
see. Call them defining statements of our Lutheranism.
And that we're heavily Eurocentric, that's just fine. I mean, if there are other people, other races that want to join our church and want to become just like us, that's okay. And, we're comfortable with our size. Evangelism. We're the evangelical Lutheran church, after all.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, that to the degree that we're comfortable with those features, we will then, the Lutheran church will be continuing to be a declining community.
Do you know what the percentages are now on how many females are in seminary in comparison to males? Because I heard it was growing and getting either closer or passing 50-50.
Yeah, I couldn't say right now what it is.
It's past 50 in the Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't know that that's the case in the Lutheran seminaries. Mary and I just did a retreat with a group of seminarians at Wartburg Seminary over in late March, it was certainly a mixed group, but I think it was still the majority of them were male.
Well, in college, there are more females going to college now than males.
Sure.
It's going to depend on the seminary, too. PLTS will probably be more attractive to women.
That could be, yeah. It would vary with the seminary, probably. So. But that would be a statistic that would be easy to find out, actually. Just one more comment. We've got to move on to some strengths, don't you think?
I was going to comment on the Eurocentric thing, and one of the fellows in a neighboring community, which that particular Lutheran church is from the ALC tradition, for whatever that's worth, mm-hmm. and there's a heavy Hispanic population in the area. It's a steel mill, steel town, this stuff. He said it's really kind of strange. Here we've got this Norwegian Lutheran church, and when the young gals in the church are getting married, they're not leaving the church, they're bringing their husbands in. Mm-hmm. So now we're looking at this Norwegian background church with Ramirez and Rodriguez mm-hmm. and Gonzalez. He said it's really kind of neat.
Oh, yeah.
But there's more of that, and I think as our culture is more accepting to ethnic group marriages, as mm-hmm. we're getting, then maybe some of that heavy Eurocentricism will dilute out.
But then you've also got to change, you've got to do something with the worship, too. For instance, I've attended a couple of times, and my daughter has attended their Hispanic Lutheran church in Minneapolis. And, I mean, the service is entirely in Spanish. They have a little band that plays, and it's you know, kind of heavy in beat, you know. And so they do the Western Rite liturgy, but they do it with a Latin beat. And so there's some common, you know, you bring in that culture. You don't just sort of ask them to accommodate to the European way of doing things.
They've got the new hymn book that just came out by Augsburg. That's African American motion. Mm-hmm. It's really neat. It's got some music that's kind of Bible schooly cute, but the service is really well done. Mm-hmm. And a lot of music that is a lot more lively than what we're used to.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we visited a couple African American Lutheran churches in Chicago too, and that's a different experience as well. Yeah.
Because there was an African American synod originally. I mean, before the big merger.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on, shall we, so we can look at some strengths there, so we don't just end up with the weaknesses. I was identifying them as charisms. A charism, as you may know, is just a Greek word that comes from gift. It means gift. And here you think about, we can use the Paul's image of the body, the church is the body of Christ with many members, you know, and these members have various gifts. They're not all the same. Similarly here, what are the gifts that the Lutheran tradition has? We don't have all the gifts. No particular tradition of Christianity has all the gifts. But what are the charisms, the particular gifts that the Lutheran tradition has? And I've identified, I guess, six here. First is there's a strong kind of theological or doctrinal heritage. Not all churches have that, by the way. The Presbyterian Church certainly does. Roman Catholic Church certainly does. But for instance, say in the Methodist tradition, It's much more has to do with the music, I think, than it does with the doctrine. Or in the Episcopal Anglican tradition, again, it has to do more with the worship. The Book of Common Prayer is kind of what holds it together. And it's not that doctrine is not at all significant, but that's not really kind of one of the great strengths of that tradition. Well, I think in the Lutheran tradition there is a strong doctrinal heritage, and that has a kind of stabilizing effect on that tradition. Maybe some people would say it would hold it back, but no, I think it has a kind of, gives it a stability, a kind of depth. And for instance, the writings of Martin Luther. Now, the writings of Martin Luther, of course, belong to the entire Christian tradition, but Lutherans are particularly interested in Luther. And Luther is one, I mean, if you were to name the really great theologians in Western Christianity, the really great, the towering ones, you know, I would name St. Augustine, Martin Luther, John Calvin, and Thomas Aquinas. Those four. I mean, that's a very select circle. And just as Thomas Aquinas does not belong only to Roman Catholics, but to everybody, yet it's been the case that Roman Catholics have paid a lot more attention to Thomas Aquinas than Protestants have. And so it is for Lutherans as well, that there have been times, we've forgotten at times in our history about Martin Luther, haven't paid a heck of a lot of attention to his writings. But like, say, in 1817, the 300th anniversary of the putting up of the 95 Theses, well, there was a big, you know, people said, we should pay more, just have a kind of celebration here, and let's look again at Luther. And there was a sort of a Luther Renaissance that came out of that. And similar things have happened later as well. And that has fed kind of new life into the Lutheran tradition, but also into the broader Christian tradition as well. Luther's writings were one of the major sources of some of the theological vitality that started in this century and right after the First World War. Some of the theologians of that time went back to the great reformers, particularly Calvin and Luther. And so I think that's a strength. A second strength I would identify here is that our serious reading of the human situation is one that is we share in common with the Reformed tradition, I believe, but it is a reading of the human interpretation of the human condition which is not a popular one. It does not seem all that reasonable to most people. The reading, it goes like this. The Lutheran reading goes like this, that we are truly in bondage to sin, and it is God and God's grace alone that is able to set us free. God's grace alone. It's by grace alone that we are saved. Now, most of us down deep don't really believe that. I think most people believe that it's really, God has to do most of it, but, you know, I've got to do my part too, you see. And so it's maybe God does 70% of it and I do 30% of it. So that seems much more reasonable to us. And that's people in the church. And so when you're talking about the massive folk in America, for example, most people think that it's a much more deeply cooperative enterprise. God doing so much, but I doing my part as well. Now we could get into talking about the various ins and outs of that, but so what? Well, that is an important contribution, I think, to the society, because we're a society, and I think modern cultures have been that way, in which we look for this or that movement or this or that person to be a savior. You know, first it was Adolf Hitler, then it was communism. But then you look at this kind of the movements that have gone through America as well. You know, kind of the social change movements that have become popular. I mean, right now it's kind of the ecological movement, or it can be feminism. And there's lots of good in these things. But sometimes, I mean, the tendency of people is to kind of see them as kind of the savior, you know, it's coming over the hill. And so that this kind of Lutheran reading of the human condition, that our bondage to sin is probably much deeper than we normally tend to think, is an important contribution, I think. Thirdly, our stress on justification by grace through faith. Now, that's to kind of use the doctrinal language. Let me just explain that. If you ask Protestants generally, do you believe in justification by grace through faith, they would say yes. But the Lutheran, there's kind of two aspects of grace that are talked about in the Christian, of redemptive grace in the Christian tradition. One aspect of that grace is the grace that transforms us, changes us, makes us more like Jesus, makes us more faithful to God, more loving towards other people. That grace that changes us. All right? The second aspect of grace is grace, God's grace that accepts us. That includes forgiveness of sin, but it's broader than that, God's acceptance of us. Now, I think every other Christian tradition, really, ends up placing the primary emphasis on the transforming grace. That's where the main accent falls. All traditions talk about both transforming grace and forgiving grace or accepting grace. But I think every other tradition in Christianity places the primary emphasis on the transformative grace of God. The Lutheran tradition alone, I think, places the primary emphasis upon that acceptance or forgiveness. Now, how is that a strength? How is that a charism? Well, when a tradition places the primary emphasis upon transforming grace and a subordinate emphasis upon forgiveness or accepting, when it gets off track, as religion tends to do from time to time, right? You know, it tends to not quite get things right, it gets out of balance, a little whack, off the track. When it goes off track, it tends to go in the direction of works righteousness. In legalism, that's the direction it goes. And that's been the way that, for instance, Roman Catholicism, when it goes off track, that's the direction it tends to go. Now, that's where the Lutheran reminder that, hey, we are saved by God's unconditional love and acceptance for us becomes very important. Ours is a distinctive voice then in the Christian community in that way. Now, of course, we have our problems, the Lutherans do too. Our tradition tends to get off track also, but when we get off track, we tend to go the other way. We tend to say that, well, yeah, God forgives me, God accepts me, you know. Doesn't need to be any change, you know. Just kind of go on being, doing what I'm doing. And so it is, but within the Lutheran tradition, that there have been voices that have, well, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, cheap grace, costly grace. I mean, the lingo has been picked up, it's become common language. But, say, he's reminding Lutherans, don't go for the cheap grace, costly grace. What is costly grace? It is grace that includes both acceptance and forgiveness and transformation. It's both. That's what costly grace is for Bonhoeffer. Now, he's not the first to call attention to that in the Lutheran tradition. In any case, what I'm saying is that it's not that Lutherans have it right and everybody else has it wrong. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that I think this particular emphasis in the Lutheran tradition is a particularly precious charism or gift that we have to offer, not only for fellow Lutherans, but for the whole Christian community, because we can be that reminding voice that helps perhaps other traditions when they get off track, you know, that, well, there is this acceptance side that's really the basic thing. Now, they'll help us when we get off track, too. We need one another. I think a fourth strength is our great musical tradition. We have a great musical tradition, both of art music, really by fine musicians, some of the great religious music of the world has been produced by Lutheran composers. And yet also great really fine congregational music as well. Now, we're not the only ones. I mean, the Methodist tradition also has great music. But we are one of those traditions in Christianity that has a great musical tradition. Lots of sorts. I mean, for instance, I'm thinking here, there's a family I know in Decorah, where I come from, where the wife grew up Lutheran and the husband grew up Catholic. So what they are now is that they are members of two churches. They belong both to St. Benedict Catholic Church and First Lutheran Church. All right? They're members of both. And I remember the Catholic husband saying, this is maybe about 10 years ago, and we were talking about at some point about some we were singing some hymns that had been left out of the LBW. And he says, and how they were such great hymns. He says, well, to belong to a tradition where you've got great hymns that you, in excess of great hymns. Because, you know, the Catholic tradition, has had, they haven't had that business of singing congregation for very long, and they're kind of trying to catch up there. Our dialectical ethics, I think, are that kind of last step. I can't really explain that without a whole lot of talk, but again, I think the Lutheran interpretation of ethical issues has been such that we have we've been able to affirm some good things about various social movements, and yet we've also raised questions and reservations about them. This also applies, by the way, to how a church college, what does it mean to be a Lutheran church college? That a Lutheran church college has a different kind of interpretation of what it means to be a church college than, say, a college in the Reformed tradition, or a college in the Roman Catholic tradition. Or certainly a college in the more evangelical fundamentalist tradition. So, I think that's, again, it's not that...
Is that a consistent thing? Because we, in our Presbyterian colleges, they go from A to Z. I mean, they're just such a broad band. I mean, not a consistency, but what it means...
And that's true in Lutheran colleges, too. That is to say, you can look at some... Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. You look at its mission statement, and it says absolutely nothing about the Christian faith. Or even, I don't know if it even mentions religion. It has historically had some connections with the Lutheran Church, but so far as being faithful to that tradition, you know, I think in all... for all practical purposes, it's gone.
We get material from them because she's ready to go to college, and we couldn't tell it was a Lutheran college. We didn't know why we were getting that.
Yeah.
We had no idea by looking at the material.
I don't have the same view.
You don't have the same view? What do you mean?
About Gettysburg, I don't know. It seemed like a wonderful Christian college.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Well, read the mission statement sometime.
Yeah, I know. Never read sometimes.
Look at the mission statement.
Sure, so you can tell.
Yeah, look at the mission. Read the mission statement. Compare it with the mission statement, say, from a Lutheran college or a St. Olaf college, and they are significantly different in what they say the college is about. But, in any case.
What a mission statement says and what the institution does can be very different things. So just because you have a mission statement that says a lot of religious stuff doesn't necessarily mean it's practiced, and vice versa.
And vice versa.
And maybe the mission statement maybe doesn't say it, but it's actually practiced. So.
Well, but the mission statement, you're right. I mean, there isn't a one-to-one.
I'm just saying that theoretically that could be what's going on here with Gettysburg.
Yeah. There's obviously, I would say, there must be some Christian community at Gettysburg College.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But what you've seen, it doesn't really seem that way.
Pardon?
But what you've seen, it doesn't really seem that way.
Well, I'm just saying that how they understand themselves in reference to,
okay.
Like, you see? I mean, you could say there's a Christian community at the University of Pennsylvania. See, there's a Christian community at Grinnell College. So there's Christian communities of probably every college and university in the country, but how does the college how does the faculty as a whole see itself in its understanding? What is it about? And that's where that is articulated in the mission statement. Now, there isn't a one-to-one relationship. Not everybody, the mission statement is not going to be agreed by everybody in the college faculty, for example.
Are most faculty at Luther College Lutheran?
No, not. Oh, okay. Well, I suppose that there's probably about half of them that are Lutheran. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be Lutheran. You can be Lutheran and not...
Oh, yeah, I know. I was just curious.
Okay.
I'm not
Maybe because you can have some... You don't necessarily have to be Lutheran to endorse the kind of...
Oh, yeah, I know.
lose an understanding of college. You see, just as you could be Roman Catholic, or you could be Lutheran and teach at a Roman Catholic institution and affirm what its kind of understanding, you see. And then finally, I think the stance of commitment to core Christian traditions along with respect to freedom towards secondary traditions is one that stands the Lutheran tradition in good stead in a kind of pluralistic situation that we are in today, where there's individuals are looking at various religious traditions and seeking to find a religious practice that will meet their needs, and so that there is a kind of freedom towards religious practices, including non-Christian religious practices, at the same time that the emphasis falls upon integrating those practices into a Christ-centered faith. And that's that kind of core commitment, I think. Well, anyway, I'll pause there, stop there, and see if there's comments or questions on any of these, and maybe there's other strengths that you would see, or some of these you wouldn't see as strengths.
I guess I would ask to point number six, for you to define or compare more specifically core Christian traditions and your statement to the freedom towards secondary traditions.
Sure.
And what you're seeing in relative to this plurality.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'm not quite sure what you're asking, but I'll take a stab at it and see whether or not that's answering it. By core, I mean, for instance, that if you look at the Augsburg Confession, which is the primary statement of Lutheran in the Lutheran tradition, the first thing it takes up is the doctrine of the Trinity. Second, it talks about sin. Third, talks about Jesus Christ. Fourth, justification by faith. Then I think it goes on to talk about baptism and Eucharist. Now those are the basic things. See? Those are, but when you get into things like your worship patterns, what they did is they did continue to use the Western Rite liturgy, which was practiced in the Roman Catholic tradition, but with some editing. But then they did it because I think in large part because they thought, well, it's a good service. And we don't want to disturb people. We don't want to upset people anymore. It was already a time of great upheaval. We don't want to disturb them even more. So it wasn't necessarily this is the way it had to be. And there was never any one version of that service, the Western Rite liturgy. I mean, there were different versions of it kind of floating around. And there was never one of them that was ever regarded as the. And Luther, Luther himself says, no, he was, resisted trying to impose or set up one version as being the authoritative. I don't know, does that speak to what you're concerned about? Any other comments or observations?
One just personal one.
Sure.
I'm not going to debate the great musical tradition because that is true in the Lutheran Church, but I know attending a Mennonite church, and they don't have the broad composure background, but four-part singing is a given there. The first Sunday I walked in, every hymn is always four-part singing, and I find here now, having been there for 7 years, being here at Holden, you don't get that. Now, there's a different musical tradition, and they all think they have the best choirs, just like the Lutheran colleges all compete with the best choirs and stuff. But it's just interesting how musical traditions develop and how different denominations own that themselves. Mm-hmm. And Lutherans clearly do have Bach and all that. But I think that right now, today, we're missing some of the four-part singing that, because Mennonites started with no musical instruments, that would be given in their congregations. They bring that strength to us that Holden has enough musicians here that just that's being lost in the Lutheran tradition.
Mm-hmm. And that green LBW sure did a good job of destroying a lot of the ability to do four-part harmony.
But just familiar hymns that we've had here still, I don't think that churches would do that.
Yeah.
That thing about the familiar hymns, I don't know how many of you were in the choir last night, if anybody, okay, when he was saying, well, everybody knows this, right? Duh.
Very few of those last night,
and a lot of things, so that's definitely one of the secondary traditions, is which are the common, well-known hymns.
I think most congregations probably struggle with defining some of that kind of stuff. Maintaining some of that history, introducing new music into congregations that are, it's tradition to be, and finding an easy blend or an easy mix of accomplishing that, because you always end up upsetting somebody. That's not the way we did it before.
Well, on the other hand, if you just do the things the way you've always done them, you miss out on connecting with a lot of other folks, and so it is a tough way. We have to be open, I think, to new music, new forms of music, new songs. At the same time that we also are able to adhere to use some of the old ones, because those are the ones that often, for some of the older members anyway, touch their heart. So that's
tough. our congregation is since January has been trying to introduce contemporary service, and defining what that is and stuff, and maintaining liturgy, new music, you know, and all that, and so there's this debate that is going on, you know, of some of the historical songs. Mm-hmm. And so last night, and I remember we were here a year ago, and it was the same thing, that for me, and it was virtually all of those songs that were sung last night were kind of old, well-known, traditional songs, you know. And I thought, geez, here's, you know, a setting where we're hearing traditional, the old hymns that everybody is familiar with, in a very contemporary setting, a very different setting in any case, that will give me some ideas, I guess, to go back, because we struggle with this contemporary service and trying to reach out in a new way for evangelism and stuff. And I kind of look at that service and I say, well, after the surprise of the music goes away, what's left? And then how have we changed anything that reaches out in a different or a better way or you know, traditional way?
But I think you need to be careful, because in this mobile society now, I mean, here's two of us saying, those aren't familiar hymns, and I grew up Lutheran. I was Lutheran for 30 years. And I see that in the church I am now too. It depends on where you grew up and exactly. What your background is to what familiar hymns are. And the same thing with liturgy. You can't just assume because somebody's coming from another Lutheran church in another part of the country. You could have been two ELC churches before the merger. Two LCA, it looks like you're pretty close and similar, but you may not be. The assumption when that sort of thing is made in a bulletin, that stuff isn't written in there. You want to be more inclusive of people. You not just have to look at the unchurched, but even people with the same church background. Moving across the country or across the world, that we have.
It's a real, very real dynamic matrix, because into that play you also include, for at least in our congregation, we have an influx of people that come from more than Lutheran backgrounds. And it's Baptist and it's Presbyterian and stuff. And so how do you, you know, try and combine all of it? I have the honor of being on our worship and music committee, and one of the things that I've discovered is that if you ask 30 people their opinion about something, you get 40 answers. No matter what you choose, there's going to be somebody that's wishing you weren't doing it.
Yeah.
And they will vocally let you know, more so than the people who like it.
Yes.
Well, our church has been incorporating the praise songs. I'm in Seattle, and we have a lot of praise music on Christian stations in Seattle. And they either put them in the bulletin or, you know, with a copy with the music and so forth, so people can sing them. And they incorporate that right along with the traditional hymns that fit that praise song, and most of those are psalms, from the psalms, and that is just wonderful. The young people are just loving it, and you know, filling our church as well as the older generation. So that's been a real blessing to me. I love those old, or not old, but the praise music that is made up of psalms.
Right.
And that's kind of a new thing that we're doing.
Your comment about things that should be written on the bulletin. Our pastor, we're looking for a new one, and I've become semi-permanent liturgist. And the first couple times up there, and you to say, what the devil was he doing then? You know, you really don't pay attention to all those fine little details until you have to do it yourself. I'm almost in favor of everybody having it up there to be liturgist. I've never been on music and worship. My choir director, and she keeps saying they need men on music and worship, but not me. She won't let me there. But she did say she had great fun the one year when there was one woman who was all in favor of more gospel type stuff, and another guy who really wanted to go back to the black hymnal. Trying to put that balance in there is not easy.
Yeah. I think in our church and in the Presbyterian system, that music is sort of becoming the issue. Mm. It's like the thing that's going to take us into the next millennium. It's, you have in our church alone, we have a Saturday night full on rock and roll almost. We have a praise service at 8:30. We have a traditional service at 11. But what's happening is the balance. What's happening is you're sort of having three separate congregations, and right. You're also having the majority of your membership is. It used to be the traditional. It's not anymore. And we're also finding that the younger people are less willing to compromise than the older generation. They want what, and they turn off their radio when they come in, and they sort of want what they want, and they want it now. They don't want to work they don't want to work in the process.
Mm.
And so we always try to do what we call blended services.
Mm-hmm.
At least once a month or something like that, and it will be the young people who will not like it, or the younger folks. I'm talking about the X generation, age up to about 30, who will be less willing to enjoy that or be able to experience worship. They get hung up on, you know, what the music is going to be.
Mm-hmm. So. It's interesting that you say blended service, because when we talk about that as well, we have kind of come to understand is that we're communicating to ourselves, and relative to evangelism and reaching out into the community, when somebody drives by and sees on the reader board blended service 8:30, what does that mean to them?
We don't tout it as being a blended.
Oh, we put it right on the reader board. Blended service, 8:30. And so it's blended service.
Yeah,
it
gives you the impression of kind of having it.
Yeah, blended service. What do they do there?
Well, our time is run out here, so we're supposed to quit, so people have time to get to dinner. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's really